knowledge of optometry.
Good morning again, Your Honors, Counsel. I represent Wendy Verwey, the plaintiff and appellant in this matter, and as you're aware, we are appealing from the district court's entry of summary judgment against her on her two claims of sex discrimination. She was hired in June of 96 by the College of Optometry as an administrative assistant to the Director of Facilities Operations, and at effective June of 2000, she was terminated, and her main claim at the district court was that the termination was due to her sex, that being female. And our position in a nutshell, Your Honors, is that there is substantial evidence not only to establish her prima facie case, but also to show or by which a jury could find that the reason given by the defendant for her termination, that of downsizing, was pretextual, so that this case should have survived summary judgment and properly go to a jury on all issues. With respect to the prima facie case, the only matter really at issue is the fourth element, and that is whether or not we established evidence that Ms. Verwey was treated less favorably than a similarly situated employee not in a protected class. It was our position that that similarly situated employee was a man by the name of Howard Hook, a male who, at the time that Wendy was terminated, essentially was doing her exact position. He was in her office, sitting in her desk. She had been instructed, ordered to train him to do every aspect of her own job. And he was, at least in our version of the evidence, doing her exact job. Even though she was terminated, even though he was arguably less qualified, he had a history of maintenance, had no experience in administrative matters. He, in fact, took over her position. So clearly we've established enough evidence that a jury would find that Mr. Hook was, in fact, similarly situated and treated more favorably than Wendy, and that he got her position and she, in fact, was terminated. The second main issue was the pretextual argument. Again, the college claims that this termination was due to downsizing. And I think there was a plethora, and a more than a plethora of evidence before the district court that this reason was, in fact, pretextual or phony. Perhaps the best evidence were the negative comments, and I'm not going to go through, there's a barrage of them contained in the briefs, made by Opie Nyman, who had taken over the department at the time of her termination, negative comments about women in general and about Wendy specifically.
What evidence do you have to show that it isn't true that Rounce informed Nyman of her decision to fire Verwey only after the decision had been made, and that Nyman took no part in making that decision?
Right. That was the crux of, I think, the district court's opinion, whether or not there's any evidence that he had a role in that decision making. While Laura Rounce claims that he didn't, there were admissions made by Mr. Nyman himself to a man by the name of Ralph Pisa, that he, in fact, was the man who made the decision, that he, in fact, collaborated and talked to Laura Rounce about this, that she was in agreement with him on this decision. There's evidence of a voicemail message. This is not disputed. Ms. Rounce admits that she left a message on Opie Nyman's voicemail that said, essentially, "You owe me big time. I got rid of her." Even though that message came after she...
But how does that show that Nyman was involved in the decision to terminate Verwey? It's an unpleasant statement, perhaps, but what's the linkage?
Well, as you know, Your Honor, we are entitled to argue circumstantially, and clearly a jury could look at that coupled with all the other evidence and find that this shows some sort of a prior... You can't look at the message in isolation. It suggests a prior discussion between them, a prior agreement between them, a conspiracy between them, if you will. Also, Laura Rounce's own testimony is relevant on this issue. She says, you know, other positions were eliminated, and she describes those positions, and she says, well, in each of those cases, I consulted with the department head. I'm in human resources. I needed their input and before I can decide who should be eliminated and who shouldn't. But yet she expects us to believe in this single instance she made this decision in isolation without input from Opie Nyman, who was running the department at the time, who was actually in the department for years working with Wendy. So I think her own testimony on this point is suspect, and actually supports our version that she, Opie, was in fact at least equally responsible for the decision, if not more than that.
Was there actually a reduction in force? How many people were involved?
According to the defendant, and after a period of time, 13 positions were eliminated. However, there were some people who took early retirement, and I think most importantly...
Of those 13, or
Right, of those 13. And then the most important point, I think, is that the only evidence of there being a replacement is in this situation involving Wendy's position. In all other cases, the positions were arguably, according to the defendant, completely eliminated. Nobody was put in them. In this case, however, we have evidence of just the contrary, that we have a male doing exactly what Wendy was doing. So it's very suspicious and suggests... And
the positions held by the other 12 were not assumed by other current employees?
Not... My best recollection of the evidence of the record, there's no evidence of that. And the college may argue differently, but my reading of the evidence, I've seen no indication that any of these other positions were filled in by anybody else.
What, are you contending that they hired 12 new people?
No, that they simply just eliminated the positions altogether.
Well, that's what we're talking about,
downsizing. Right. But in this case, they're claiming they eliminated the position of administrative assistant, but then they turned around and they put a male. I don't know what they've called him, but he's doing her exact job. That's the difference. And that's where I think the evidence of pretext comes in. And in addition to that evidence, there's also evidence of statements made by Ms. Rounce herself. There's some case law that says statements of a decision maker are evidence of pretext. In the past, she'd been approached by Mr. Pisa about this problem he perceived and the way Mr. Nyman was treating Wendy, his remarks, his discriminatory attitude, and her response typically was, well, you're opening a can of worms, you know, you may be risking your job, et cetera, et cetera. So, and finally, there's evidence of sexual harassment. While there's no sexual harassment claim, the underlying facts to that claim, the pornographic pictures, that rather than being taken down, the response was, well, she shouldn't be, Wendy, a woman, shouldn't be back there anyway. Again, that just goes to show this anti-female attitude, not just in the college, but specifically in Wendy's department, which, again, goes to pretext. So if you don't have any further questions, we would just ask that summary judgment be reversed and that this matter go to a jury for resolution, as there is sufficient evidence to support our claim.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Mark Furlane on behalf of the Illinois College of Optometry. May it please the Court. Ms. Rounce wore two hats. She was not only the Human Resource Vice President, but she also was the Executive Vice President. And as the record demonstrates, she was recently, before the decisions involved here, made the head of the facilities department over Mr. Pisa, who was the director. He reported directly to her. So while she did consult with the other executive committee members about the reductions in force, it was they who were making the decisions as to their respective departments, and she was the one who was making the decision relative to the facilities department. And it was admitted in paragraph 38 of our 56.1 statement that Ms. Rounce made the decision to eliminate the positions in the department. And Mr. Pisa, who was a male, his position was eliminated, and he himself was terminated. And his assistant, Ms. Burway, her position was eliminated. And she, rather than being terminated, was offered another job in the bookstore. She claims that it was an inferior job, although it did pay 23% more than her position. Now, Ms. Burway, and we agree with counsel that the fourth prong of the prima facie case analysis, McDonnell Douglas, is the only one really applicable here. And we don't believe, as the district court found, that she met that burden. Hook was a 23-year employee who admittedly was a maintenance department employee during that period of time. And while there was some dispute as to whether he could, because of some physical problems, do each and every one of his responsibilities, he had admittedly done them all in the past. And she admitted that she couldn't do some of the responsibilities that were going to be required of that job. And it was undisputed that Mr. Hook, while she claims that he continued to perform all of the functions of her job, he continued to do all of the functions of his job, plus whatever parts of her job remained. And if you look at the record sites that they rely on, you'll find that they have not put into question that Mr. Hook's was, they have not put into question that some of her job was eliminated, some of her job went to other people, some of her job went to Mr. Hook's.
What about the 12 other RIF people? Were they similarly treated, that is, perks were assumed by other existing employees?
You know, I don't know that the record...
record doesn't indicate...
It doesn't indicate it one way or the other, because we did not identify that as an issue that we were dealing with, and nor did the plaintiff suggest that in any record evidence that they either were or were not replaced by someone else. I mean, their jobs were eliminated. She made the point that some of them retired rather than actually being terminated or transferred.
But we do know, of course, that Hook and Nyman absorbed her job responsibilities.
There's testimony of Mr. Nyman in the record as to what happened to some of the responsibilities, and the district court found just by virtue of the fact that she no longer was going to be an administrative assistant to the director because that position was eliminated. Mr. Nyman, who maintained all of his existing job duties, was then taking on some of the additional managerial responsibilities that the director had previously performed. So there is, in our 56.1 statement, an assertion to that effect, and there's record testimony by Mr. Nyman that she has not contradicted as to what happened. Matter of fact, if you look at how she attempts to contradict that Mr. Hooks didn't perform all of her job or exactly her job, she relies on some hearsay testimony from some secretaries that she talked to in August and also a contractor who had gone in there at some point in time and had said that he saw Mr. Hook sitting at her desk, and it appeared to him doing some of the things she was doing. And she admitted in her deposition that she didn't have any personal knowledge as to what Mr. Hooks was doing after she left, only that she had trained him on responsibilities and didn't know what he was doing from personal knowledge, and there was no other testimony of Mr. Pease or anyone else contradicting Mr. Nyman's statement as to what Mr. Hooks was doing after that period of time. She is right also, the crux of her claim appears to be that Mr. Nyman was involved in the decision, and essentially she points to three parts of Mr. Pease's testimony. One was some early 1999 discussions that Pease said that he had with Ms. Rounds about complaining about Mr. Nyman being discriminatory, to which Ms. Rounds responded that they were going to be giving sexual discrimination or discrimination and diversity training. Also, there was a comment that and this was after Mr. Pease had already been terminated and after the discussion Mr. Nyman and Ms. Rounds had, in which Ms. Rounds told him that she'd made the decision to eliminate Mr. Pease's and Ms. Burway's job and to transfer Ms. Burway to some other position when one came available. And Mr. Pease had indicated that in that discussion, Mr. Nyman had said that he wanted to get, or words to the effect that he would wanted to get rid of that position and get male in there. But he never, Mr. Pisa never pointed to any admission by Ms. Rouse or Mr. Nyman that Mr. Nyman had made the decision. In that regard, Mr. Pisa only argued in his testimony that he thought that he made the decision because he'd always wanted to get rid of her. But the fact that their ultimate conclusions, Mr. Nyman didn't want her around, and Ms. Rouse ultimately didn't want her around, doesn't establish that they were based on the same motivation, doesn't establish that Mr. Nyman was involved in the decision. And, in fact, there was no evidence in the record that disputes Ms. Rouse's and Mr. Nyman's testimony that Mr. Nyman was not involved in the decision. Now, as to the wage discrimination issue, I don't believe that she's established a prima facie case because she hasn't established that the males and her job were the same. She admits they were maintenance employees. After a union election attempt and the union backed away, there was a wage survey done. Ms. Rouse determined that the salaries of the maintenance employees was below par for similarly situated educational institutions, and she immediately decided to raise those. On the contrary, Ms. Rouse, who was perceived by her and who was essentially a clerical and administrative employee, fit right where she should be in terms of the wage surveys, and based on that, she made the decision. There was no argument or claim that Mr. Nyman was involved in that decision, and in fact, there was nothing to show that the surveys decision by Ms. Rouse based on those surveys was in any way related to sex or motivated by the relative sex of the parties involved. That's all I have, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counselor.
Questions? Thank you.
You have 2 minutes.
Just a couple brief points. First of all, with respect to Howard Hook, Wendy Verwey has direct personal knowledge that she was instructed to train him to do her job. She has direct personal knowledge that she did, in fact, instruct him to do every aspect of her job. It is undisputed that he assumed at least some of her job. And importantly, there's no evidence on the record that any other of these terminated positions were replaced other than Wendy Verwey, Wendy Verwey's position. So on that alone, I think we've met our burden. As with respect to Laura Rouse, it not only defies the evidence, it really defies common sense to think that she was somehow able, a human resource person in a company as large as the college, to make a decision about a department where she'd never worked, about an employee who she'd never worked with. Clearly, Opie Nyman had involvement in that decision, and his comments, therefore, are very important. His discriminatory comments should be considered because they are important on the issue of pretext. And finally, the wage discrimination claim is a smaller claim. I think they've come up with a supported legitimate reason as to why the only female in the department did not receive a pay increase. I think all the pretext evidence in our termination case is important to establish pretext in this issue as well. Plus, we have a prior situation where Wendy had been doing Howard Hook's a lot of his maintenance work, where Ralph Pisa had attempted to increase her salary because of that, and he was met with very, very harsh resistance by both Laura Rouse and Opie Nyman on that prior occasion. And I think that also there's case law that says previous similar adverse decisions can be looked at to show pretext in this case. And I think for all those reasons, summary judgment was inappropriate, and there is enough to get this case to a jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, sir. We will take the case under advisement.